The content of this program is intended for the blind and print-impaired audience. Hello, Michael Blakely here with Religion in the News. For the next 28-odd minutes, I'll be reading various news stories from our wire services on the subject of religion. The program is generously underwritten by White Memorial Presbyterian Church, to whom thanks. They can be reached at 919-834-3424. From The Economist, first of August 5th, Faith, Finance, and the Future of Humanity. Remembering Tessa Tennant, giant of green finance, a rainmaker who cajoled the religious and made them greener. Last November, investment managers and prominent figures from many faiths, including Christians, Muslims, Jews, Buddhists, and Taoists, gathered in the Swiss town of Zug and agreed to help each other direct the vast financial assets controlled by religious bodies toward projects that help rather than harm the earth. Out of that meeting sprang an initiative called Faith Invest. Its declared aims include the establishment of a, quote, pipeline of investable projects in line with faith-consistent principles. Ethical and religiously inspired investment used in years past to focus on the avoidance of bad activities, like selling weapons to dictators or cigarettes to youngsters. The Zug meeting marks a more recent emphasis on using investment to help the environment in active ways, say through renewable energy or sustainable forest management. The deployment of billions of dollars could be affected. That was one landmark in the history of ties between religions to which most humans adhere and people who are responsible in one way or another for the physical state of the earth. Another such landmark occurred in the run-up to the Paris Summit on Climate Change in 2015. In a project called Our Voices, people of many different religious and philosophical convictions came together to express their hopes, demands, aspirations, and prayers for a successful summit. What unites these two initiatives, one in the realm of the practical, the other more moral and spiritual, is the individual who acted as a prime mover in both cases. Her name was Tessa Tennant, and she died last month at the age of 59 after a long battle with cancer. Although she wasn't physically present in Zug, its success was a reflection of relationships and networks which she had established, and moral pressure which she had applied, according to Martin Palmer, the organizer of the gathering and Secretary General of the Alliance of Religions and Conservation, or ARC, a non-governmental organization, or NGO. The Our Voices campaign reflected another inspiration of hers. Instead of pretending to be one more green lobby group, the religions of the world should try to influence the Paris summit by doing what they do best, exhorting, inspiring, and praying. One of the many paradoxes of Ms. Tennant's life is that she had a huge impact on the world of faith without being formally religious herself. She had plenty of influence in other quarters, too. She co-founded Britain's first green investment fund, now known as the Jupiter Fund. She established the Carbon Disclosure Project, which prompted thousands of companies to make annual statements about their greenhouse emissions. And she worked closely with the United Nations Environment Program to develop good practices for banks, insurance firms, and investment funds. She was remembered at the ARC office in Bath as being a joyously manipulative person to whom it was impossible to say no. The Zug Faith and Finance meeting was the culmination of a long series of deliberations that began in a conversation between her and Mr. Palmer in an icy Scottish castle nearly 20 years ago. She asked him how much money religions had and what they were doing with it. He had just been talking to the treasurer of one of America's main Christian churches, who said its pension fund was about $13 billion and total financial assets around $70 billion. Ms. Tennant and Mr. Palmer agreed that something could be done with this money. Ms. Tennant's own Scottish stately home, which passed to her from the eccentric blue-blooded family into which she made a short-lived marriage, was by all accounts a much warmer place. People with interesting ideas about finance, ecology, philosophy, or any combination of the above were invited to brainstorm and were then browbeaten into putting their ideas into practice. In metaphysical terms, says Mr. Palmer, Miss Tennant was closer to Pelagius than to Calvin. In other words, she refused to believe in man's incorrigible wickedness and felt that humans had the capacity to take action to save themselves. But it seems very unlikely that she paid the slightest attention to either of those thinkers. Faith Invest is now planning a meeting in Hong Kong, where leaders and prominent practitioners of Asian belief systems, including Hindus, Buddhists, Taoists, and Confucians, will be invited to turn their metaphysical beliefs into ecological practice. The concept and the contacts which underlie that plan are all part of Ms. Tennant's bountiful legacy to the Earth. And from the Religion News Service now, of August 10th, a down payment on making Hajj easier for Muslim women. To prepare for this year's Hajj, the annual Muslim pilgrimage to Mecca that begins August 19th, Mariam Ali, a Los Angeles social worker and the eldest child of the late Muhammad Ali, has been spending time in saunas and walking in the Southern California heat to get acclimated to Saudi Arabia's 110-degree weather. She has also been watching her spending. The financial commitment is often the toughest challenge Muslims face as they try to complete one of the five pillars of the Islamic faith. The Massachusetts-based travel company Adam Travel, for instance, offers 9 Hajj packages this year, costing between $7,490 and $22,500 per person, depending on the length of stay and quality of accommodation. Despite her father's success, Ali, age 50, says she has always lived off her social worker salary and never had $8,000 laying around to make the trip. A few years ago, she started putting money aside, even foregoing a 50th birthday party, she said, so that she could one day make the journey. Ali had already made a down payment to a tour group when she was connected to the Haja Project, a group founded in Los Angeles a year ago by Krishna Najib, age 63, a human resources specialist who converted to Islam in 2009. After returning from Hajj 3 years ago, Najib realized how common it was for women to forego the trip. Not only is money a frequent obstacle, but family duties, health, and even how women think about pilgrimage all prevent them from going. This year, Ali became the first woman selected to receive help from that group. Putting off things for themselves is just part of being a woman, Najib said. We take care of the family, we take care of our children, we take care of our husbands, we take care of our parents. I wanted to do something that would inspire and educate women to want to make Hajj a priority in their lives. Today, with 7 other female volunteers, Najib organizes educational and community events to raise money for aspiring Hajjas. Najib said the fledgling group has raised $1,500 so far. When Najib first decided to go on Hajj, she didn't expect money to be a problem. She and her husband put $10,000 down with a Hajj tour group, thinking they had another month to come up with the rest of the payment, but 2 weeks later they received a call asking them for the balance of $4,000. So she and her husband set up a GoFundMe crowdsourcing campaign to raise the remaining amount. For some people it was inappropriate, it was not Islamically sound, said Najib. For others it was like, oh, good idea. And that's when the Haja Project was born. I didn't want anyone else to have to go through that. If you're serious and Allah has accepted your request to go on Hajj, she said. The Hajjas Project doesn't fund anyone's Hajj entirely. While Najib said she would like to increase the amount of cash gifts and the number of people who receive one, fully funding a woman's pilgrimage, she believes, would take away from her intention to make Hajj. For Ali, the project's $500 contribution is a crucial boost to her spending money while she's in Saudi Arabia. More important than the money, Ali said, has been the advice the Haja Project gave her. Najib and others she met through the project told her to have patience. It's not going to be perfect. There are 2 million, 3 million people there, Ali recalled them saying. They also gave her tips on how and where to wash her clothes and what to expect from the bathrooms. Even though Hajj is spiritual, there are a lot of logistics to adjust to, said Ali. They let me see a visual that you don't get in any of the tutorials on YouTube. Noor Abbas, an engineer from Los Angeles, said the group's support has been critical. I attended another Hajj workshop and read books and things like that, and it's always from the male perspective, said Abbas. I learned all the rules, but I wanted to get more of a woman's perspective and hear what it's like from our side. Not least among the practical help Najib's group provided Ali and Abbas was a heavy-duty backpack filled with toiletries, a headscarf, a prayer booklet, snacks, and built-in water storage. That eased a lot of anxiety, Ali said. In reducing women's concerns about Hajj, the Hajjah Project hopes to change women's thinking about the pilgrimage. As a young single woman, performing Hajj never crossed Zariya Horton's mind. Now, as a therapist and educator who serves on the project's leadership team, Horton said that when she was growing up, Hajj was for elders. "It's for people who have the time to take off a month," Horton said, "and not for people who need to work or care for children. Who's going to look after my kids for a month?" Part of the Hajjah's Project's answer is to encourage people to go when they're younger, after high school or college graduation, or in between jobs. "I want to inspire someone younger than myself to take the opportunity, like after college, and say, 'Sister, have you thought of Hajj? Have you thought of it before you have a mortgage, before you have kids?'" said Horton. Most important for Najib is the spiritual renewal the pilgrimage brings and the ripple effect it has in the Muslim community. The Hajjah Project's work, Abbas said, is an example for other Muslim women. "It shows that women should be doing this and can be doing this and have the support of other women if they are doing this." And from the Associated Press now, of August 10th, Tennessee has carried out the execution on Thursday of a man condemned for the 1985 rape and murder of a 7-year-old girl, marking the first time the state has applied the death penalty in nearly a decade. Inmate Billy Ray Erick, 59, received a 3-drug injection at a maximum security prison in Nashville and was pronounced dead at 7:48 p.m., authorities said. He was convicted in 1986 in the death of Paula Dyer, a Knoxville girl he was babysitting. The blinds between a witness room and the execution chamber were opened at 7:26 p.m., and Erick could be seen through glass windows strapped to a gurney, an IV stuck in his arm, and leading back through the wall to a room hidden by a mirror window where someone administered the drugs. Asked if he had any words before the chemicals began flowing, Erick at first appeared to sigh and say, "No." But then he said, "I just want to say I'm really sorry, and that's it." Then the execution proceeded. A minute later, his eyes closed. Snoring and heavy breathing were heard. At 7:34 p.m., there was coughing, huffing, and deep breaths. An attendant began yelling, "Billy!" and checked the inmate and grabbed his shoulder, but there didn't seem to be any reaction. Minutes later, Erick let out a cough or choking sound as his face turned dark purple. Then he appeared to stop making noise and was soon after pronounced dead. Hours earlier, Thursday, the U.S. Supreme Court cleared the way for the execution, denying Erick's request for a stay. But Justice Sonia Sotomayor issued a blistering dissent, recounting details from a recent state court trial of a case brought by inmates contesting Tennessee's execution drugs. Erick's attorney, Gene Shiles, said his client was stoic in his last hours and accepted what would happen with a lot of grace. Erick ordered up a burger, onion rings, and a soft drink for his last meal and spoke with chaplains, Shiles said. It was the first execution in Tennessee since December 2009, when inmate Cecil Johnson received a lethal injection for the 1980 killings of 3 people during a Nashville convenience store robbery. Since then, the state has endured legal challenges and difficulties finding execution chemicals, including its previous drug, pentobarbital. On Monday, the state Supreme Court had also refused to block Erick's execution, saying the lawsuit filed by inmates involved the execution drugs wasn't likely to succeed. That case is continuing in a state appeals court. In a ruling last month, Davidson County Chancellor Ellen Hobbs Lyle wrote that attorneys for 33 death row inmates, including Erick, didn't prove that there was a substantially less painful means to carry out an execution, or that the drugs the state planned on using would cause the inmate to be tortured to death. Tennessee's execution protocol called for use of midazolam as a sedative, the muscle relaxer vicuronium bromide, and then potassium chloride to stop the heart. At question is whether midazolam is actually effective in rendering someone unconscious and unable to feel the pain from the other 2 drugs. Federal public defender Kelly Henry said at trial that inmates were tortured to death, feeling like they were suffocating, drowning, and confused. Henry said in a statement Thursday night that witness observations suggest the midazolam didn't render Erick fully unconscious, and those accounts were indicative of pulmonary edema from the drug. Attorneys for the state have said the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld the use of midazolam in a 3-drug series. Once Erick was dead, Attorney General Herbert Slattery said justice had been delayed for too long for the little girl killed and her family. A small group of the victim's family members watched in a separate viewing room. They opted against speaking at a news conference afterwards. I hope tonight's lawful execution in some way eases the heartache Paula's family has lived with and brings a degree of closure to a chapter of their lives that had been indescribably difficult, Slattery said in the statement. In Nevada, the drug company Alvogen has sued to block use of midazolam in a stalled execution. Tennessee is one of 15 states siding with the state of Nevada against the company, though Tennessee is planning to use a version of the drug that is compounded, not directly purchased from a manufacturer. Supporters and opponents of the death penalty turned out Thursday evening in places around the state. The Tennessean newspaper reported death penalty opponents gathered around Tennessee in several churches and are outside the prison before the execution. About 50 protesters were outside the prison, while others who support the death penalty also showed up as authorities kept the two groups apart. The execution comes a week after Pope Francis revealed new Catholic Church teaching that deems the death penalty inadmissible under all circumstances. Prior to the Pope's emboldened stance against the death penalty, three Catholic bishops in Tennessee wrote Governor Bill Haslam, telling him that the death penalty contributes to the growing disrespect for human life. Haslam declined on Monday to intervene in Eric's case. Back to The Economist now of August 10th. Reviving pre-Christian religions. Neo-paganism offers something old and something new. Attempts to recreate the nature-loving worship of old are gaining popularity, even if they are hard on, based on guesses. In a quiet location on the northwestern edge of the United States, a group of devotees gather around a bonfire to celebrate the summer solstice. They begin by lighting a candle dedicated to Brigid, a holy figure from early Ireland whose shadowy tradition is linked with poetry, healing, and the skills of the blacksmith. Attire at this late-night session is casual. Most people wear jeans and T-shirts. One member of the 25-strong group carries the flame around the circle while sprinkling water from a well. Then, sitting among pictures of pre-Christian deities, the attendees act out a ritual using a script which runs to 6 pages. People who know the modern mythology of C.S. Lewis or J.R.R. Tolkien might recognize the style, though it hardly rates as high culture. The Herald says, "By the power of star and stone, by the power of the land within and without, by all that is fair and free, we welcome you to this rite of Alban Hefin in the seed group of the Circle of Call. East, we have come from east, west, north and north, and south to be here together today." The participants are practicing neo-druidry, a form of devotion that seeks to recreate the sacred world of the Celts that existed before the arrival of the Romans, and later the Christian missionaries of the British Isles. Although Ireland and Wales are thousands of miles away, the devotees draw heavily on the lore and language of Celtic lands, ancient and not so ancient. The term used for the summer solstice, Alban Hefin, was dreamed up by a Welsh antiquarian in the 18th century. How much the earnestly enacted rites and simple verses used by this group resemble anything from the distant past is unclear, but various forms of paganism seem to offer an attractive modern path to the transcendent. According to Ronald Hutton, a professor of history at Bristol University and an authority on modern pagan religions, over 100,000 Britons probably practice neo-paganism, and perhaps 5 times that many Americans. As Professor Hutton uses the term, neo-paganism refers to forms of worship which regard nature as sacred, which acknowledge feminine deities and celebrants, which eschew the idea of divine commandments, and which aspire to recreate the pre-Christian religions of Europe and the Middle East. Two of these subgroups within this general heading are the Neo-Druids and the Wiccan movement, which follows a revival in witchcraft that was pioneered by Gerald Gardner, a British writer and archaeologist. It's hard to tell whether neo-paganism is growing in size, given the movement's loose structure and the fact that some Wiccans keep their affiliation secret. But in recent decades, pagan religions have steadily gained recognition from all branches of authority, especially in the English-speaking world. In the United States, neo-pagans can look back on a series of hard-won successes. In 1985, a district court in Virginia declared that Wicca was clearly a religion for the purposes of the American Constitution's First Amendment, which guarantees the free exercise of faith. In 1997, Fort Hood in Texas became the first American Army base to allow Wiccan practices, and several more have followed suit. And in 2007, as a result of a court settlement, the American government allowed the pentacle, a Wiccan symbol, to adorn military graves. In rather different ways, neo-paganism is recognized in Britain. The country's prison service recently advertised for chaplains who would be expected to provide for the religious care of prisoners and staff in the pagan faith tradition. An employment tribunal has laid down that bosses must respect the spiritual needs of any Wiccan workers, which might include time off at Halloween. The University of Edinburgh is one of several campuses with a chaplain who caters to the needs of pagan students. Professor Hutton argues the Druid and Wiccan practices of today are valid forms of pagan religion, even if they are based on self-conscious revivals in the 18th and 20th century, respectively, that were not rooted in certain knowledge of earlier practices or beliefs. As the professor and other experts acknowledge, it's impossible to be sure what sort of people the Celtic Druids really were. Modern understanding is largely based on the biased views of Roman historians or Irish or Welsh annalists, writing centuries after the subject matter had vanished. One feature of ancient Druid practice that is no longer acceptable is animal sacrifice. That does not mean that modern Druids practice their religion falsely, insists Professor Hutton. It simply means that human needs have moved on. Back to the Religion News Service now of August 10th. For military families, this church aims to be manna from heaven. The Thursday evening service at Manna Church packs a punch that more than rivals large Sunday morning services elsewhere. As people take their seats, the band's thundering bass bounces off the walls, a fog machine spews smoke-like vapors, and previews of coming youth events and special guest appearances flash on the auditorium's three screens. As the non-denominational service concludes, hundreds of people stream outdoors. Kids twirl hula hoops and toddlers play a parachute game in the fading late summer light. Adults line up at the edge of the parking lot for food trucks dishing out burgers, hot dogs, and tacos. This dynamic megachurch is similar to many others across the country, except for this. 70% of church members are military families based at Fort Bragg, the nation's largest military installation. And despite a rapid turnover of members due to deployment, retirement, or transfers to other bases, this non-denominational evangelical church has not only held steady, but grown. There are 3.5 million military personnel in all branches of the armed forces. Of those, about 1.2 million are active duty, and about 40% of these identify as evangelical. At a time when many churches are struggling to hold on to members and millennials express a flagging faith, the founder of Manna Church, Senior Pastor Michael Fletcher, thinks he has found a way to keep many of those young military families by building a church home for them wherever they go. Over the past 3 years, the church has grown from its flagship Fayetteville location to 8 churches serving mostly military families across the country. They include one in Colorado Springs, Colorado, near Fort Carson, another in Niceville, Florida, near Elgin Air Force Base, as well as outposts in Newport News, Virginia, by Langley Air Force Base, and Honolulu, near multiple bases. In each new location, it has relied to a large extent on a core group of soldiers who had attended the flagship North Carolina church and are able to carry the congregation's culture to their new assignments in other bases. Now, Manna Church has set an ambitious goal: to open a campus in every city that has a large military base. The neat thing about planting near an Army base is we already have a bunch of families out here who used to go to Manna Church in Fayetteville, North Carolina, said Joe Adams, pastor of Manna Church in Colorado Springs. So when they heard we were coming out to start Manna in Colorado Springs, they immediately said, "We want to be part of this. We want to help." The Colorado Springs Outpost has the same name, logo, and vision statement as the Mother Church, and it tries to develop the same culture. After launching in a community college auditorium in January, Adams had 469 people attending Sunday services by the end of July, an impressive start in a town with no dearth of evangelical churches. That goal of opening new churches along what Fletcher calls the military highway took shape 3 years ago when he reviewed a report showing the church had lost 1,143 people to transfers and retirements that summer. To stay even, the church would have to add that many members before the year was out. Out of my mouth came the words, "I'm tired of people sending people from us to nowhere, so I'm going to plant a version of Mana Church near every U.S. military base in the world," Fletcher said. As soon as I said that, I realized, well, that's God's plan for us. Fletcher has led the church for 3 decades, taking a group of 350 that had formed out of a Bible study at a halfway house and boosting it to 9,300 members in 8 locations, 2/3 of them in Fayetteville. Along the way, he's learned something about church growth. In a book he wrote about leadership, he argues the key to a thriving church is offering people a set of easily understandable steps to help them develop as believers and as church leaders. Fletcher's method, which he calls the growth track, calls for putting new believers through a series of 3 small group classes he calls first step, next step, and leader step. Those steps may help Mana in replicating its success elsewhere. Staff Sergeant William Rainier, a public affairs specialist who was transferred from Fort Bragg to Fort Carson last year, said he was comforted by knowing that he could find a church home in a congregation he already knew. With military families, anytime you move, you have to completely rethink your entire life. Where you go grocery shopping, where we go to the dentist, where do I get my hair cut, and where do I find a church that's what I'm used to? When he found out that Mana Church was starting a new plant in Colorado, he saw it as a sign. It just really felt like God saying, "Hey, I'm sending you to Colorado Springs for this reason. It's time for you to get involved and take the next step and grow more as a Christian." Other churches across the country have also developed a niche competency. Some also cater to military families, but Mana has taken it further. "They understand the mindset of service people and their families very well," said Dave Travis, a senior consultant at the Leadership Network think tank and consulting firm for large churches. "They benefit from positive word of mouth because people who came through there and are now deployed elsewhere in Germany or Afghanistan, they say, 'Here's a place that gets military people.'" Diana Juergens joined the church in 2005 when she and her husband, a soldier, returned to the States from an assignment in South Korea. Within a month, she had formed a support group for soldiers' wives in her Fayetteville home. When the group topped 18, she called Mana Church and asked if it could meet there. "Mana immediately said yes," said Juergens. "My Wives of Warriors group that started in my home has been going on for 13 years. That's a prime example of how they support the military family." Juergens is one of 381 such small groups at the Fayetteville Church alone. The church encourages people with a particular interest to form groups that help one another grow in their faith. These are small groups devoted to building decks, shooting guns, reading books, feeding the homeless. Our job is to help people who become who God called them to be, not just harness them as resources to build a church. Melissa Holcomb, a wife of a soldier who attended a Thursday night service in Fayetteville recently, said other churches tended to form cliques that aren't always welcome to military families. "They don't understand that you're not putting roots down there," she said. Mana was different. Well, that's all the time we have now for Religion in the News. Thanks very much for listening. Thanks to White Memorial Presbyterian Church, 919-834-3424. This has been Michael Blakely. I'll talk to you later.